It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. The Trump administration reverses another Obama position. It's federal protection for transgender students to use the bathrooms of their choice in the nation's public schools. Here is Press Secretary Sean Spicer yesterday hinting at the rationale a few hours before the official reversal.
Right now, that's an issue that the Department of Justice and the Department of Education are addressing. I would tell you that, and I think that there'll be further guidance coming from DOJ in particular with respect to not just the executive order, but also the case that's in front of the Supreme Court. The president has maintained for a long time that this is a states' rights issue and not one for the federal government. So while there will be further guidance coming out on this, I think that all you have to do is look at what the president's view has been for a long time, that this is not something that the federal government should be involved in. This is a states' rights issue.
The Trump administration still says transgender students can't be discriminated against. Meanwhile, Democrats continue to show up in droves in this week of congressional town hall meetings, and the candidates for Democratic Party chair held a televised debate last night on CNN. Who will replace Debbie Wasserman Schultz to try to lead the Dems out of the political wilderness? Maybe it'll be this guy, surging at the moment, Pete Buttigieg. I don't even know if I'm saying his name right, but our guest will help me in a minute. He's a 36-year-old gay Afghanistan war veteran and mayor of South Bend, Indiana, asked this question last night by CNN's Dana Bash.
Mayor Buttigieg, you are an officer in the Navy Reserve and served in Afghanistan. At a previous forum, you called President Trump a draft-dodging chicken hawk and warned against sending Americans back into conflict. Is that the way Democrats running for office should talk about the commander-in-chief?
Look, we've got to face what we're faced with. This is somebody, this gets me emotional, because you got somebody who, as a millionaire's son, used his privilege in order to avoid serving. And look, military service isn't for everybody, but for somebody who did that, to then see fit to turn around and attack the people who did serve, and even attack them over their service, that is unconscionable. You know, the fact I was never rich, but I felt privileged with a Harvard degree, that was one of the reasons I felt I needed to go into the military. He used his privilege to stay out. But again, you know, I got to say, I even find myself feeling the need to do things like call him something really tough, because he's bringing out the worst in us, all of us, his supporters and his opponents. We need leaders who will bring out the best in us. That's what leadership is all about.
Buttigieg got the endorsement this week of former DNC chair Howard Dean. He also has former chair and former Pennsylvania governor Ed Rendell and others. Or maybe it'll be Bernie Sanders' pick. Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota, the first Muslim congressman, out to make common cause last night with American Jews.
Donna Brazile went to the Bernie supporters and she did issue an apology. That happened. Now we have a unity commission, which is going to be appointed by somebody in this group. And I think we absolutely have to make sure that in the future, every person who wants to vote for a Democrat must feel that it was fair, open, and accessible and transparent. That is a mission. But I'm telling you, the real problem is ahead of us. People are organizing in the street right now. I believe I'm the unity candidate in this race because I supported both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And I believe I can pull the people together so that we can come together as a party and we can win elections so that we don't ever have to go through this thing anymore.
Well, that was not the clip I thought it was going to be, but it was Keith Ellison trying to make common cause between Bernie supporters and Hillary supporters in the party. Labor Secretary Tom Perez, Obama's former labor secretary, got kind of tripped up on that question. He's considered a front runner, but he was on the wrong side for the base of TPP. He supported it. And he had a hard time last night when asked if the Democratic primary season was rigged because of what Debbie Wasserman Schultz was revealed to have done.
Secretary, 10 seconds. Was it rigged or not?
Again, the process, because of the absence of transparency, it created that crisis of relevance. And it created the distrust that people didn't trust the outcome.
Mr. Ronan, was it rigged or not?
Thank you. I was going to interrupt anyway. The point is, Not only was the primary rigged, it was also rigged all across the country because the DNC has never allowed outsiders or brand new people to rise through the ranks. It has always been an insider game, and it has been that way for a very, very long time. That is where that lack of trust has come into play, because not only was Bernie Sanders snubbed, not only did it look like Hillary Clinton had bought or muscled her way into it, then those supporters were denied a chance to speak at the convention, and that was the final straw. If people don't have a voice, an equitable voice, like I alluded to earlier, then people are not going to trust the system, and they are going to go out of their way to break it.
Dark horse candidate, 27-year-old Air Force veteran Sam Ronan, no equivocation on that, like Perez. And I don't think anybody's talking about activist attorney Peter Pekarsky, who was also on that debate stage last night. But listen to this when he was asked last night about voter ID by moderator Chris Cuomo.
President Trump asserts that more than 3 million people voted illegally in 2016. He has offered no valid proof of this assertion, and yet the perception has caught fire. You have expressed concern about this perception and that it will lead to a chilling effect and potentially more voter suppression, maybe more voter ID laws. If that is true, what would be wrong with that?
What would be wrong with more voter ID laws? Is that the question?
It is your choice to answer a question with a question. Yes.
What would be wrong with more voter ID laws is
yes.
that the ones that exist are, in general, a violation of the U.S. Constitution.
We will hear more clips of other candidates for DNC chair as we go. With me now, political reporters Eli Stokels from Politico and Molly Ball from The Atlantic. Hi, Eli. Hi, Molly. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, great to be here.
And listeners, if you're a Democrat, who do you want for DNC chair? Or anyone on the transgender reversal, or anyone on anything in the news of the day, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Eli, most years no one even knows who the DNC chair is, no less give the candidates a primetime televised debate. Does it actually matter more this year?
I don't think so. I can't for the life of me fathom why anybody would spend their Wednesday night sitting before their television watching those folks debate. I mean, you know, this is where we are maybe politically, where it's just sort of overtaking the culture. But, you know, for all the CNN's efforts to make that look like an exciting, consequential political debate last night, my understanding, I don't generally spend a lot of time covering the Democratic side of the aisle, but my understanding talking to folks who do, is that the two favorites to win are the party stalwarts, Ellison and Perez, a cabinet secretary and a member of Congress. And that, you know, ultimately who leads the party is far less important than whether the party can come up with a candidate and a message in this very fragmented, you know, cultural moment who can sort of bring back some of the voters that were lost last year. I don't know that the party chair is a figurehead, even if it's someone charismatic like the young mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who maybe has the sort of sharpest political skills as a sort of politician, someone who can carry that message themselves. You know, I don't know if that figurehead is really going to mean as much as sort of the message that is ultimately put forward by a candidate. You've got to have a candidate. You've got to have someone to sell this in 2018 and in 2020 especially, and I just don't think that the party chair really means all that much.
Molly, any different answer on that?
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with Eli here. I think the fact that the Democrats are in such disarray and so on the rocks, I do think Eli's right that, you know, rank-and-file voters, swing voters, persuadable voters out there in America aren't on the edge of their seats waiting to see who the DNC chair is as the main sort of figure opposing.
Molly, we're having a little trouble with the sound on your line. Can you,
sorry.
We'll rehook it up if we need to, but can you come a little closer to your microphone by any chance?
I'm practically eating it. How's that? Can you hear me?
All fixed. Thank you very much.
Okay. But what I was going to say is that the chair of a political party has a lot of very important functions, not so much in being on television or being a member of the public debate about things, but in strategy, in fundraising, in trying to bring together a fractured and demoralized and dispirited Democratic Party that if it is going to have any hope of regaining greater relevance, particularly in the upcoming midterm elections when you don't have the unifying figure of a presidential candidate, which, of course, they will have in 2020. I think in a midterm election especially, there's so much on-the-ground work that a chair can do to try to bind up some of those wounds from 2016, to try to get the party's fundraising back on track, and to try to get some operations going in the states that that will seek to win elections going forward.
Yeah, my own view is that I tend to think there's the opportunity for whoever wins this job to play a significant role in national politics, more than usual for a party chair, because the Democrats don't have either branch of Congress and don't have the presidency, like you were saying, Molly, and there's so much energy in the Democratic Party right now because there's so much revulsion against Trump, and the party is fractured. So what wing of the Democratic Party, what personality of the Democratic Party is going to be the one to try to lead them to victory of at some level in 2018 and beyond? So it might be somebody from Congress. It might be a mayor or a governor. It might be the DNC chair. So I think it's significant because there's at least the opportunity for that right now. And the two leading candidates, like Eli said, have been said to be Tom Perez and Keith Ellison, with Perez representing the Hillary wing and Ellison representing the Bernie wing. Molly, how accurate a shorthand is that for them?
Like any shorthand, there are some nuances to it, but that's basically accurate. You know, they do represent also different visions for what kind of party it's going to be. You already have a new Democratic organization that wants to run primaries against any Democrats in Washington who give any ground to the Trump administration work with Republicans at all, reminiscent, as many have said, of the Tea Party back in 2009. And so there is a large, all of this energy that we've seen in the protests in the streets and the Democrats energized against Trump, that's a double-edged sword for whoever tries to lead the party, because a lot of that energy now is being directed against Democrats that they see as insufficiently pure, insufficiently oppositional. So this is a bit of a tangent on my part. You were asking about Perez and Ellison, but you know, for someone like Perez, who really is supported by the Hillary wing of the party, which is still a very powerful wing of the party, which is, you know, the majority of activist and traditional Democrats, as proved by the fact that she won that primary, he's getting a lot of resistance from these very energized, a lot of them new to the party, a lot of them not traditional Democrats, a lot of them pushing the party to be more progressive, shorthanded as the Bernie wing, but it is a lot of the new energy in the party. And I don't think that Bernie Sanders even controls it. It's just more of this base energy coming somewhat from outside the party and wanting to overturn the old order that they think failed to win the last election.
All right, help me out here, you guys. Buttigieg.
Think Buddha and judge.
And there are no J's in that name, I will just say, for the record, in the
soft
spelling.
G's.
Judy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My question is, who gets to vote for the DNC chair?
Aha. Now, Eli, it's... do you know, or you're covering the Republicans, so I should ask Molly this one.
I cover the White House, but I believe it's the few hundred DNC members. I think there's what? How many, Molly? 400, 500?
447 members of the DNC, if I'm not mistaken, and they come from all 50 states all over the country, many of them elected by local Democratic activists.
And there's going to be an in-person convention where they're all welcome to come and vote this weekend, or can they vote remotely?
They are convening, I believe, today at the DNC winter meeting in Atlanta.
Richard in Midtown. You're on WNYC. Hello, Richard.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Richard.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The comment I wanted to make in terms of who we support or who I would support and who I urge people to support is Mr. Buttigieg. I think I've learned how to say it now. I watched the debate last night and listened again to the clips, even from last night, the responses from the what I would call the political insiders, Mr. Ellison and the ex-secretary. That's just, it gets your blood boiling. And this is exactly what we're exhausted with in politics and in the Democratic Party. And I just urge people to vote for Mr. Buttigieg because we're just exhausted. We need something fresh. It's done. We cannot do this again for another 4 years.
Richard, thank you very much. Daniel in Babylon, you're on WNYC. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how's it going? Can you hear me?
Can hear you fine.
Okay. This is the thing. I actually like Keith Ellison as a choice. One, he's coming from the right place. The biggest mistake that they made in the last election, as everybody knows, is putting forth Hillary Clinton, who was far more establishment than any of the people that were even on the cusp of. They weren't necessarily Trump voters. Could have really gone for. He was far, because Perez was, they put forth Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders had the energy, just like Trump. He just didn't come from a place of xenophobia and hate, as many people think, as many people widely agree. Now, the thing is, I like the apparatus. I like I like Perez. Perez was a very successful labor secretary. He's very articulate. He understands the people. He understands the bare bones of it, and he's himself a very, almost an activist type of person. That's where he comes from, as far as his background as a labor secretary and the jobs he had before. I wish those two people, if we could put together a Perez with Bernie as opposed to the other way around, because if they use Perez, the same reasons why people voted against Hillary would be the same reasons why many people, if they had half a brain, would vote against Perez, even though he as a person is a very poignant and learned candidate for the position as DNC chair. And any ideas that he has would definitely come from a place that people would resonate with the actual voters, with the actual people. He has a plan. He spoke of it when he was on Bill Maher just a few months back.
And Daniel, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for your call. I'm going to play two short clips, 30-second clips, of two other candidates who were there last night. One is the South Carolina State Democratic Party Chair, Jamie Harrison, who weighed in not really liking the whole line of questioning about whether people are in the Bernie wing or the Hillary wing, or whether people would do business in Congress with Trump on bills they agree with him on, or just say no to everything that Trump comes out with. So listen to what Jamie Harrison said.
So if Democrats want to be in a permanent minority, let's spend all of our time and energy fighting each other. But if we want to actually fight back against Donald Trump, let's spend our energy going after Ted Cruz. Let's spend our energy going after the Republicans that are up. We don't have the time, the energy, and all of the people that we are fighting for each and every day don't have the time for these purity tests. We have to fight back against the Republicans. We can't fight each other.
Jamie Harrison, the South Carolina Democratic chair. And here's 30 seconds of Sally Boynton Brown, the Idaho Democratic chair, on her response to the new Trump immigration orders.
Listen, state control is really, really important. We have to have local control. And I think these states have the right to pass their own laws and have the citizens in their state follow those laws. Yes, there is a place for the federal government. However, the Republican Party has been saying forever that the federal government has too much power, right? This is one area that I agree with the Republicans. The federal government has too much power. We need to make sure that all of our states have the ability to come back and follow their local laws and pass those local laws. And there's way too many instances of that just not happening.
Sally Boynton Brown at the Democratic chair, DNC chair debate on CNN last night. So Eli Stokols from Politico, let me come to you on that point, because here's kind of a political paradox. Here is Sally Boynton Brown defending states' rights when it comes to immigration so they can protect their undocumented immigrants. And there is the Trump administration at almost the same moment announcing that it's backing off some federal civil rights protections for transgender students because it's something that should be left up to the states. So I guess it depends, you know, on what the issue is and whether the state or the federal government is on your side of the issue, whatever the issue is, whether somebody is for more state power or more federal power. You could talk about that in the abstract if you want. And also tell us what happened with this transgender ruling.
Well, yeah, it can seem a little hypocritical, I guess, if you're talking about it in the abstract. But because this is something that people sort of look at, I think, maybe on a case-by-case, issue-by-issue basis, you can understand why in some cases, you know, the only means to pushing something in the direction you want is to, you know, change your point of view on states' rights. I think in regard to the transgender bathroom protections, Donald Trump changed his view. Donald Trump initially, I don't think he really cares too much about this. I think, you know, LGBTQ rights are one of the areas where progressives would actually say, well, I think Trump actually is a little more progressive than maybe in some other areas. And he said, you know, initially when asked about this, probably the best distillation of his own personal views on this is, I don't really care. You can use any bathroom you want. No big deal. This doesn't matter.
I think he said in one of the debates, I think it had come up in a debate around Caitlyn Jenner, and he said, right. Oh, Caitlyn Jenner can use any bathroom she wants at Trump Tower, something like that, right?
Right. And then very shortly after, someone got in his ear and told him that the correct answer for conservatives would be that this should go back to the states and be settled on a case-by-case issue. And that ultimately is where the administration is going on this. And the people who appear to be pushing this in that direction are the Vice President, Mike Pence, who feels more strongly about this. And the Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos, actually came into conflict with the Vice President on this. He and Attorney General Jeff Sessions are the ones who feel strongly about this and I think ultimately got their way by rescinding the Obama administration's order on the transgender bathroom rights. But really, you know, this is maybe something that they felt the need to do ostensibly for legal reasons. I think politically it is one of these sort of reassuring things to the social conservatives in the base that they decided to go ahead and do. On the face, you know, I don't know what the legal implication is exactly, you know, but I do. The politics are clear. The symbolism of this and the message that it sends is clear, and it's definitely not a unifying message of tolerance, as the president was trying to sort of put forth when he went to the African-American History Museum earlier this week.
They did, Eli, try to make the point somehow, even walking away from this and saying the transgender bathrooms and schools policy should be left up to the states, did try to make some point about this doesn't mean that we condone any discrimination against transgender people and that they're still protected by federal civil rights laws. How far did they go with that?
Well, I mean, but words are very cheap at this point. I mean, this White House often talks out of both sides of its mouth about issues like this, and they say, well, of course we want people, you know, to come together, but the policies don't really line up with that. Of course we still want these people to have rights, but the headline that they know they're going to get is Trump scraps Obama administration transgender rights directive. Trump takes these rights away from people. And so that's the headline that they're getting. They know that that will benefit them with some of their political base and that will outrage others. And they're willing to live with that.
Molly, what would you add as political analysis to this decision?
Well, I think it's a fascinating case study in the sort of battle for the soul of the Trump administration. Given that Trump has not been in politics before, and given that he said so many contradictory things and sent so many contradictory signals during the election, there have been real questions going in about which way his administration would go. And as Eli said, this is a case where social conservatives felt like they got Trump elected. They were owed some of their political priorities. There was a fight within the White House for whether they would get this particular priority of theirs or not, given that Trump has also tried to send moderate signals and to seem to be a more LGBTQ-friendly president than past Republican candidates. In this case, the social conservatives, who are very well organized, particularly within the Republican Party, they got their way. And what I will be watching is to see, number one, are there a series of state-by-state battles as states, particularly red states, which is most states, try to enact some version of the North Carolina law? And number two, is there a backlash from the business community, as we saw in North Carolina, as we saw in Indiana, as we've seen in other states that try to enact so-called bathroom bills, where the business community has been the strongest voice opposing those kinds
right,
of laws.
Right. And one example, if people don't know it, the NBA All-Star Game, which was supposed to be held on Sunday in Charlotte, got moved because of that conservative bathroom bill, quote-unquote, and general LGBT rights diminishment bill or ban on localities from passing LGBT rights anywhere in North Carolina. That NBA All-Star Game, which had already been slated for Charlotte, it wasn't even a question of deciding where it would go. It got withdrawn from Charlotte, and they played it in New Orleans on Sunday. So that's one example, right?
That's right. And under Mike Pence, when he was governor of Indiana, this was over a religious freedom law, which is a similar analogous but not the same issue. There you also had a huge backlash of the business community in defense of gay rights against a socially conservative piece of legislation, and the business community won.
All future NBA All-Star games will have to be played in New York and California as of, well, we'll see how this goes in the states. Sherry in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because, number one, I'd like to see Keith Ellison.
Okay.
I think he would be fantastic. And I'm tired of the Bernie side getting ripped off by the Democratic Party. The second thing is this transgendered bathroom bill. I am so heartbroken. My partner and I recently, after 25 years, got married because we could see basically the writing on the wall. When Trump picked Mike Pence to be his vice president, both of us simply figured they were going to go after gay rights or LGBT rights, no matter who it was. And they're doing it. He is keeping his promise to his people, much to the horror of the rest of us. And to all those people out there that were saying things like, well, Ivanka and Jared have a lot of gay friends, a lot of LGBT friends, and they're talking him out of it, forget it. I don't think the community should put its life in the impotent hands of Ivanka and Jared.
Sherry, thank you very much. So, Eli Stokels, is there other stuff in the pipeline or that could potentially be in the pipeline pertaining to LGBT rights? Or is the bathroom bill in sort of its, you know, own category of controversy and maybe political opportunity right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think I there are a lot of things in the pipeline. I mean, this is an administration that during the transition and continues to have, you know, they've drawn up a lot of different things now, as we saw with the travel ban. You know, sometimes these things were not necessarily vetted by legal experts, and so I think they're going to be careful about the moves they make going forward and not just sort of sign a bunch of orders that haven't been vetted. I don't think the LGBT issues are a huge priority for this president, and I think that this may be, you know, one place where he said, okay, I will appease the social conservatives in my cabinet, those who voted for me will do this, and they can argue that, you know, all this does is put it back to the states. We're not you know, dictating new policy really here, and I think that can be it. But, you know, you do have to just keep an eye on this White House because, you know, we don't know what they're going to do day in and day out. Sometimes, you know, the president himself is very mercurial, very emotional, responds to who knows what, you know, the slightest provocation. And I would not think that this is an issue, a policy area where we're going to see the president get out too far over his skis. But, you know, in terms of curtailing civil rights, I think this Justice Department, people are going to be paying very close attention to what they do.
Do either of you think that Steve Bannon cares about LGBT issues one way or another? I mean, if he's seen as, you know, in the worst characterization, a white nationalist, a Christian nationalist, is he also a heteronationalist?
I haven't had any indication that that's the case with Steve Bannon. And again, as Molly and I both stated, I mean, I think that this is, you know, Vice President Pence is the one, you know, pushing this, Attorney General Sessions, perhaps. Steve Bannon, I think, you know, he is indeed a sort of white nationalist in the way he views the world. And the administration generally, I think, you know, people who feel like this is an administration that is not all that considerate of the, quote, others in our country, the millions of people who are not, you know, white males, that may be a legitimate point of view, but I don't know that that it's a LGBT thing that they're trying, an axe they're trying to grind.
Eli Stokols from Politico, I know you got to jump off. Thank you very much for joining us. And Molly
Thank
Ball
you.
From The Atlantic, before you go, Bannon is supposed to speak publicly today at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. Any idea what he's going to say, or if we're going to hear a big sort of philosophy of the Trump administration in the world statement from, you know, the guy who's been seen as the puppet master behind the scenes?
I don't know what he's going to say. It'll be very interesting to see. You know, Bannon speaks pretty regularly, despite his sort of reputation as this reclusive Darth Vader figure.
He did before. I know. He had a radio show, podcast on Breitbart.
Yeah, right. And he talks to Breitbart. So, you know, his worldview is somewhat well known. What'll be interesting is, you know, does he make a sort of bland pro-administration like case, or does he try to sort of do more of the sort of philosophical case that you're outlining? And I don't have any intelligence on that.
All right. Give me one more thing as we segue to three reporters who cover the Trump administration for news organizations in other countries. We're going to have with us in just a minute someone who covers it for China, for various Latin American countries, and for Le Figaro in France. The Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. There's buzz in the last few days that he's being marginalized. They don't do State Department daily press briefings like they have typically in previous administrations. He hasn't been out front like secretaries of state typically are talking about foreign policy. What's going on with Rex Tillerson? Do you know?
Well, there are two possibilities. One possibility is this narrative that we've now seen in quite a lot of places that he has been sidelined because Trump likes to do things himself, and Trump is on the phone with foreign leaders saying whatever pops into his head at the moment, so he's not really huddling with his Secretary of State crafting policy. The other possibility is that he's just new to the job. Tillerson has never been in the State Department or conducted foreign policy before. He's trying to learn the ropes, trying to learn his way around the bureaucracy, trying to staff up a very large agency that has a lot of different experts and moving parts in it. And so I think his allies would say, give the guy a break. He's just trying to get his feet under him. But this is part of the problem this administration has had, because it has so many new faces and because it was so unprepared for the transition that it has been, at the very least, slow to get a lot of these major departments running.
Let me just get one last thought from you on the transgender policy. And I'm going back to my original states' rights question, because that's the only term in which they're talking about this from the White House and the Justice Department, that this is an education issue, schools issue. Schools is education, obviously, which they see as a local and state purview area. They're not going to say a word from the White House about leaning against LGBT rights or even transgender rights in particular. But you and Eli were really framing it that way in all of your answers. Do you think states' rights is just a complete cover for leaning against transgender people?
Well, I don't want to say that I am taking a side in this debate, but I do think that the states' rights argument is the one that social conservatives who would prefer there to be restrictions, sex-based restrictions on who can use restrooms, biological sex-based restrictions, and then you have the LGBT community and its allies on the other hand, very supportive of some kind of federal protection or protections on the state level to protect transgender kids in schools so that they can use the bathroom corresponding to their gender. And that has been the axis of this debate. Now, I think it's very similar to the gay marriage debate, where if the federal government bows out of the debate, you will have it fought at the state level or even at the municipal level. We've seen cities. In fact, it was in North Carolina, it was the city of Charlotte that sparked this whole controversy. So this is a fight that is not going to go away because the stakes are very high for both sides.
Molly Ball, political correspondent for The Atlantic, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, an international journalists roundtable on what the U.S. looks like to them and how they're reporting it back to their countries. Stay with us.